Luke's Gospel, chapter 19. I wish we could all fly over to Israel, to Jerusalem, and all of us take the Palm Sunday walk. Everybody experience the sights, somewhat the sounds. Still have to use your imagination a little bit because of how things have grown up and developed and been commercialized in some instances. And one of the biggest things to me that takes away from the picture is all of the graves that have been developed in front of the Eastern Gate, down over the hill from the Mount of Olives, and how that takes away from the whole scenario. But Palm Sunday was, you know, how do we word it really? The beginning of the end. The setting up, the stage being set for what was to take place. And that week following what we know as Palm Sunday was action-packed. There were many things taking place on that Palm Sunday walk, and then carrying right into the crucifixion. I don't know for myself, I think that the first trip to Israel, maybe some of you that have been once as well can vouch for it, but there's such an overload of information that you lose some of it. Some of these guys that have been there multiple times, they've seen it so many times and they've heard it so many times that it just begins to infiltrate their thinking a lot better. But Jesus did some things that were, you know, maybe considered to be strange, out of the norm, out of the ordinary for certain. As he is coming in up over that hill, the passage here in Luke 19, verse 29, would indicate to us that he's coming nigh unto Bethphage and Bethany at the mount called the Mount of Olives. Somewhere in that vicinity, he sends out two of his disciples, and they are to go into the city, and they are to find at a certain place a donkey and its offspring. Now, that offspring has never been ridden before. It's just a colt. It's a young one. And they are told that if anybody asks them, why are they untying it? They are to respond with simply the words, the Lord hath need of it. You know, was that a prearranged situation that was taking place? We don't really know what it's all about, but the Lord hath need of it. Now, you read through the Gospels, these accounts of the life of Christ, and I don't think that you find anywhere in these accounts where Jesus rode anything except for a boat. He got into a boat and he rode a boat several times. But you never find him riding an animal. You don't find him getting a donkey or a horse. He walked everywhere they went. I don't know how many miles that must have been. But up and down those hills, he walked everywhere that they went. But this time, he's going to ride a donkey into the city of Jerusalem. He's never done that before. Another thing that we can dig into a little bit about this particular scenario and this particular day is that Jesus knew what he was getting into when he went to Jerusalem. If you remember when he was called to go to Lazarus' sickness, to heal Lazarus, and then ultimately we know that he raised Lazarus from the dead. There was some concern then about, you know, you going back in there? Your safety is of concern here, Lord. Well, he knew what he was doing. He knew what he was going to face when he went back into Jerusalem. Maybe it was one of the most difficult decisions that he had ever made. And so then you take that thought that he was making a difficult decision to go back into Jerusalem because he knew what he was going to face, and stack on top of it that now he's riding this donkey colt. So, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, riding this colt into the city was basically a public declaration that he was a king. 500 years before this took place, the prophet Zechariah proclaimed the fact of him riding into Jerusalem when he says in Zechariah 9:9, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, daughter of Jerusalem, behold, thy king comes to you." And he concludes that verse by saying that he's riding on a colt, a foal of a donkey. Now, I'm told that in war times, conquerors would ride into the city in their chariots or on stallions, prancing stallions. I guess you have to have that word prancing in there to paint the actual picture of, you know, the high-strung horse. Now, that was in the time of war. But in the time of peace, we are made to understand that kings would ride a colt to symbolize that peace prevailed. Is that ringing a bell? Jesus said, go into the city and you will find a donkey with its colt. Take the colt. Jesus was going to ride into Jerusalem upon a colt. Thereby, he was declaring that he was the king, proclaiming peace. This was also the beginning of an 8-day Passover festival. The Jews were to remember during this time of that God delivered them, their ancestors, from the Egyptian slavery. This particular festival was bringing Jews from all over the known world at that time, and they were gathering in Jerusalem to celebrate this Passover festival. And so the city was probably full to overflowing with people. So it was pretty obvious that Jesus wasn't the only one coming to Jerusalem. We know that Pontius Pilate came to Jerusalem, the Roman governor. He was coming there to occupy the fortress, the praetorium. He was going to be in the city. And with him coming into the city, it brought a full complement of the elite and battle-hardened Roman soldiers. What a parade that must have been. You think? I don't think that they came in silently or unobserved. They came in with some fanfare. See, these Roman soldiers were of the hardened nature, and they were ready and willing to suppress any uprising that would come, that would develop in this throng of Jews gathering in against the Roman Empire, the Roman rule. Not only was Pontius Pilate there, but Herod Antipas. We could call him the ruler or the king. He's the guy that imprisoned John the Baptist, beheaded John the Baptist. And again, what do you think his arrival was like? It was probably with great pomp, great ceremony. A lot of things taking place. Probably he was going to occupy the palace that Herod the Great had occupied. And so the people of Jerusalem had seen some great power and pomp and ceremony brought into their city that week. Zechariah says See, your king comes to you. The city streets were probably lined with people. The roads were full of people traveling here and there. And Jesus was going to ride a colt into the city, making a public declaration. How do you think that people would respond to that? Oh, you have a thought going through your mind right now that they waved their palms and shouted Hosanna. The kids, the children ran around screaming and shouting about this king that was come, and they were shouting Hosannas. They were excited about him, this Jesus, coming on the colt of a donkey to set up his promised kingdom, his worldly kingdom. They were eager for him to break the bond, the bondage, the chains of Roman rule. They would not recognize that Jesus was not coming in to set up a worldly kingdom, but a spiritual kingdom. Now, perhaps some of the people that were there along the road or somewhere along the city streets, they would greet him with some laughter. Maybe they would be amused by what Jesus was doing. After all, it was a ridiculous picture. It was kind of hilarious to some looking on, because here was a carpenter that was declaring himself to be a king. A carpenter declaring himself to be a king. Perhaps some of them would think of him as some lunatic living in a fantasy world, imagining himself to be a king. And so they would laugh at him. There were some that were probably angry with him. And this is probably more than just a simple possibility. This was a reality. People were angry with him because they would interpret his riding into the city as arrogance and as blasphemy against God. Now, no doubt that there were many that hailed him with joy. They welcomed him as an earthly king, ready to reestablish the throne of David, overthrow the Roman Empire. They were eager for that. They were ready for it. They welcomed him to come and place a crown upon his head. Now, there's some people in that crowd that were healed by his hand. How many of the thousands of people that he fed were in that crowd? You remember, he fed thousands of people. Many more of them were there in that crowd. They had seen his miracles. They had listened to him speak with great authority. Some of the people in that crowd had listened intently to his message, and their lives were changed because of that message. You see, the crowd that was there was of a diverse crowd. They were all sizes, kinds, and thoughts, and everything that you can think of. Could I suggest that, understanding what I've already said, that they were much more diverse than what this crowd is? Because we at least have something in common, and that is worshiping God pretty much the same way. Now, we are all different people as such, but we would be one of the ones that would rejoice because of the change in our life from his teaching, from his ways. Jesus knew all this. He knew, as he topped over that hill overlooking the Eastern Gate and the city of Jerusalem, that there was a monster waiting to consume him. You look down here in Luke's gospel, earlier in Luke's gospel, and it tells us that in spite of all of this that was going on, Jesus still set his face to go to Jerusalem. He resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And so he rides down toward the gate of the city, and the crowds are growing. The air is becoming more and more festive. The pilgrims for the Passover are gathering in from all around. Could it be also that the news of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead has preceded his presence at this time? Without Facebook, without Twitter, Instagram, and whatever else there is, Snapchat. See, I'm grasping at straws here just from listening because I'm venturing beyond my experience here. You know, it's amazing how fast things can travel now. But do you suppose that it was possible that the story of Lazarus' resurrection, being brought back to life, preceded his arrival even here? They knew about it. And surely people were excited about that. Surely people were thrilled at the prospect here that somebody who was sick and died came back. Have you heard the news? Lazarus died, but he's been called out. He was dead long enough that they were afraid that he would stink. Jesus said, "Lazarus, come forth." Maybe blind Bartimaeus was in the crowd. You know, the beggar that received his sight. Maybe Zacchaeus was in the crowd. Maybe Zacchaeus was there. You say, well, what's so important about Zacchaeus? Zacchaeus was an outcast. And Jesus called specifically to him. Maybe Zacchaeus was there. He had paid back his debt to society. He had made his peace with God. Zacchaeus was a changed person. What about the lepers? Do you suppose that there were lepers? Cleansed lepers. Former lepers. Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. Mary Magdalene. All these people that had been taught by the Lord, and Jesus had molded their lives and had changed their lives. But then there were also some people standing around with squinty eyes and sinister faces. Probably don't have to think too long to know who they were. We know them as the Sadducees and the Pharisees. You see, they were supposed to be the keepers of the law. They were supposed to be the spiritual leaders. But Jesus, having gained so much popularity among the people that it was threatening their position of power or their position of popularity. And so they were jealous and they watched him. I don't know, so I suppose that some of the Roman soldiers were there to watch him as well. They were fearing a revolt. They were fearful of all these people coming together. They were watching. They were looking for any kind of a sign that would show up of rebellion against Rome. They were ready. They were waiting. They didn't have any qualms about crushing any kind of an uprising. Now Jesus, as he rode in, he heard the hosannas. Those hosannas were soon drowned out by the voices of those with squinty eyes and sinister faces. Those that began to chant, "Crucify him." Or even those that simply stood aside and said nothing. Can you picture Peter through all of this triumphal entry into Jerusalem with Jesus riding on that colt of a donkey? You know Peter. He's got an extra strut to his walk, an extra height to his stature. The buttons on his robe were beginning to pop because he was expanding so much. Just picture. James and John weren't too far behind. You know, they're the ones that were begging Christ to allow them to sit on either side of him. They were eager for this earthly kingdom. Do you suppose that as they walked with Jesus that they were just kind of swaggering a little bit extra and strutting a little bit more? Kick out that leg as they walked. Peter was probably thinking to himself, maybe it was worth it to leave all of the fishing nets and boats behind. A lot of things took place in this travel and in these hours. One of the things that stands out, though, as we look at this passage is that it's the second time that Scripture records for us that Jesus cried. You can read it there. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept. He wept over the city. You see, the reason why he wept here was because as he looked at the city, he saw that people had rejected him. The previous time when he wept, he saw the need of the hearts of individuals, and he felt their pain, and he wept with them. Different weeping now as he realizes the rejection. If you had only known that this day was coming, and that I could bring you peace. If you'd only followed, if you'd only listened, I wanted to gather you in. I wanted to be your friend. Gives a whole bunch more there. You can read it. Jesus didn't come to set up that earthly kingdom. He came to set up his spiritual kingdom. The spiritual kingdom that says, love your enemies and pray for those that persecute you. You see, that was the basis for his kingdom. They couldn't find themselves loving the Roman Empire. They couldn't find themselves loving the Roman soldiers or the Roman rulers. That was just a little bit of a stretch. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, then turn the other cheek and let him. If someone wants to sue you and take something from you, then let him have more, or you know, don't just give him your coat, give him your cloak also. If someone forces you to go a mile with them, then go ahead and take 2 miles. So many things that take place, but let's move quickly on and find ourselves in the upper room as they've made their way in for the Passover and the meal and the celebration. You can flip over to Luke chapter 22 and you'll find it there that Jesus tells them in Luke 22:15 that he had a great desire to eat this Passover with them. The King James tells us in pretty much very simple terms that, you know, we may not have to struggle over too much, but he said, with desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. The New American Version says, earnestly desired. The Amplified adds another word to that statement, earnestly and intensely desired to eat this Passover with you. Do we understand the concept here or the thought that Jesus is trying to portray to his disciples, yea to us, that he long. There was something deeply passionate about him at this point, wanting to spend this time with his disciples and to share this Passover with them. You say, well, what's so significant about that? Okay, look around the table and see who's there. See who's there. It's the men that Jesus called. He has spent three and a half years with them. He has walked with them. They have walked with him. They have heard his messages. They have seen his life. They have realized the testimony of all that he's done to be Jesus, the Son of God. But look at them closely as he peers around that room and around that table as they are lounging there for that meal. And he said, I have desired with intensity to eat this with you. There's Thomas the doubter. Yes, Thomas, I have wanted, deeply wanted to spend time with you at this particular meal. There's Peter the bragger. Oh no, Lord, you didn't want to spend time with him. Surely you didn't have that kind of passion for Peter the bragger. Well, there's Judas the betrayer. Is it really real, Lord, that you want to have this Passover with him? As I mentioned just a little bit ago, there's James and John, the prestige hungry men. Lord, let us sit on the one hand and on the other. Let us rule with you. We want that position of prestige and power. Lord, are you really serious that you want to spend, you have a passionate desire to spend this Passover with these two guys? How about Matthew the tax collector? Oh, whoa, 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 he's changed. Well, okay, he may be changed now, but he's still got that fog hanging over him, that reputation hanging over him. He's not a very liked person. Did I mention Peter? Oh yeah, I mentioned Peter the bragger, but what about Peter the denier? Yeah, you see, there's that guy there too. Jesus looked around the room and he saw exactly who was there and he said, with great intensity, with great desire, I long to spend this meal with you. What was he doing? He was wanting these disciples to understand that in the midst of all of their failures, in the midst of all of their problems, in the midst of all of their doubts and their bragging and their prestige-hungry desires and their denying and their betraying and the reputation of being a bad guy as a tax collector, in the midst of all of that, he says, I want to be with you. Now let's look around at ourselves. Turn right inward and look at ourselves in the face and say, does he have that same passion for me? You see, the answer to that is yes. With desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you. What a concept. What a thought. That as he broke the bread and said, this is the New Testament. This is the covenant that I'm making with you. This is the new, the transition to the new, that my body is to be broken for you, that my blood is to be shed for you, that these elements, these items are to be used for you to experience with me this New Testament, this new covenant. I know quite often we read over further in the New Testament where it says and gives us great caution about partaking. And I want us to always maintain that. But let us also understand within that Jesus is telling these disciples at the very first communion with desire, knowing, looking into their lives, seeing them in their face, recognizing all of the inadequacies that they are expressing through their eyes. Jesus is still saying with desire, great desire, intense desire, I want to spend this with you. I want to share this with you. Now, if it makes you rise up in your heart as John and James did previous to when they were wanting to have that right hand and left hand position, if it makes you rise up and say, well, my oh my, God's given me good favor here, I'm not so bad, well then you've looked at it all wrong. But if you look at it from the aspect that in the midst of who I am or where I've been, what I was, Jesus still loves me and desires that he would share this with us. In humility that we receive the sacraments of the Lord's Supper. Not bragging, not boastful, not patting ourselves on the back. Well, I'm one of his. Well, that's wonderful to be one of his. Don't get me wrong. But that we recognize his holiness and that he gave himself the body to be broken, the blood to be spilt, so that you and I could enter into his suffering with him and ultimately into his glory with him. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "Take, eat. This is my body, which is broken for you. This do in remembrance of me." And he also took the cup, saying, "This cup is the New Testament in my blood. This do ye as oft as ye drink it in remembrance of me." You don't have to feel embarrassed this evening if you decide and choose not to. This is not about embarrassing anybody. But if you would like to participate, Jesus says, you're welcome. If you know that the New Testament in his blood was shed for your sins and long to be his and live for him, the door is open for you to partake. For he said, "With desire I have desired to be with you." Knowing who they were. Yes, there's tears in the eyes of the Lord when he sees our pain and when he sees a person's rejection. But in the midst of all, he still longs to be our Savior. I'd like for us again just to move from the front rows, move back, come into the center aisle, two rows, and just you can pick up the sacraments and then go to the sides and back into your pew. If you can't come up and you'd still like to participate, have somebody get it for you or signal me and I will bring it to you. Brother and Sister Keys, I'd be happy to come to where you are. You don't need to get up. You all can slip around to the side over here instead of coming across. You know, whatever is the easiest for you, but generally speaking, just move to the center and come up. And two lines and go right through and we'll partake at the end together. Again, if you choose not to, I'm not looking down on anybody. It's your choice. But let's worship the Lord together.